Okay, we are now recording audio. And I will turn it over to Joss to kick us off with a presentation on Google Docs. Take it away, Joss.
All right. Hi, everybody. I think somebody was asking some question about Google Docs and how to use them, so I will talk a little bit about it. So as I will start probably with this is pro. In order to use Google Doc, you first have to have an account. This is something that Chris covered pretty much last week, so just kind of a quick repeat. If you go to the top of the address, myaccounts.google.com, you can create an account, enter your first name, last name. Probably the toughest part is to come up with a username that is different than everybody else that has come before you. So sometimes you have to make a lot of trial until you get one that does work for you. So once you have created the username, then you enter your password, enter it a second time, and then if everything works out fine, then you will have an account. Once you have a Google account, you get a lot of different applications. One of them is Drive, as Chris was talking last week. Another one is Docs, Gmail, YouTube, and Calendar. I mean, there's a lot of choices. So what you do in order to choose the thing you want, you just click on that little nine dots button, and then you select the Drive, and it will bring you to a place where you can select what you want to do. So in my case, if you want to do a document, you can select Google Doc, and there you will get a choice. You can start with a blank, or you can start with a template. There is a lot of choices, so in my case, I selected the one with the cat and with a title and the text. And there, and after that, it works pretty much the same as any text document. You have the menus at the top, file, edit, and so on. And you can edit your document any way you want. Once you have happy with it, you can, in order to save it, there's one of the different things between a Google Doc or on the cloud or versus your computer is that automatically your document is always online, always available. So if you look at the top right, you will see that the last time you made a modification, it will show how long ago it was. So you don't have to save your document. It's always saved automatically fairly frequently. But if you want to change the name, then you have to use rename. You click file, you click rename, and you give it the name. So in my case, I selected G Drive sample. So that's kind of little, there is some concepts, idea that takes some adjustment, but yes? Okay. One of the nice thing about Google Doc is that you can share to anyone in the world, including yourself. And one way to do it is that if you click on the button share, then you have a number of options. One of them is you can say that anyone that has the link to that document can view or edit the document as you wish. So you click on share, and then anyone with link, and on the back you can see copy the link. And then you can email that link to anybody in the world, and they will be able to view your document. And if you give them the rights to edit the document, they can also edit the document. So this is something I find very useful. For example, I am part of a board of directors, and it was nice that every director were able to share the document between themselves. And you can define Is it just you can define who can view the document, or is it everybody, or just some specific people? So you can select whatever you want. You can create documents like a word processor, like Microsoft Word, or you can create spreadsheet. So in order to select what type of document, there is another button here that you have there, select, and then give you the choice of selecting a sheet. Or another way to do it is, again, using the same menu that I was telling you just a couple minutes ago, and give you the docs, or if you want to select directly the sheet, and there it is. One of the thing that might, it's a little bit more complicated, is that if you want to read a file that is on your computer, because normally everything is on the cloud, so if you want to read a document from your own computer, then you have to do an import. So you select the file, import, then upload, and it gives you a select a file from your device. And then finally, it will let you access your computer and navigate to whatever folder you want to go and then select the file. And then it will be loaded into your into Google Drive, and you can start to edit as you want. So that's basically my little presentation on Google Doc. Is there any questions that I can answer?
We did have one question, Joss, in the chat. Ollie asked, in Google Docs, how do you create a hyperlink?
If you go, if you click on the share, it will create the link automatically for you. So you can just click on the copy link.
Okay. I think that the question was, correct me if I'm wrong, Ollie, is if you're in a document and you want to have a link in the document, how do you make it a hyperlink?
Well, my question was that a friend copied a photo, which is a link to a video, and the idea is that that photo, as she exported it from Google Docs, it was active, so you could click on the photo and it would be direct to the video. And I said, how did you do that? She said she exported it from Google Docs and chose to have it as a hyperlink.
Okay. The hyperlink is, as I said, is just a share, and that gives you I'm trying to load it there. It's a little slow here. And that gives you... it's locked. But normally, when you click on the share, it gives you the hyperlink and it gives you access to the to all the pictures or all the document as you want. So clicking on the why is not working? I don't know. I have a little technical problem. But
so it's to share the whole document. You can't just click on a photo and have it.
Yeah, in order to go for a picture, what you can go is to Google Drive and go to your pictures, for example, photos. Where are my photos?
Okay, but it wasn't just the photos. The photo was part of a link to a video. So it wasn't just letters, but it was a picture that you clicked on and it went to the video. Anyway, that's okay.
I think I understand what's going on there. Normally, Gmail in particular, if you email a link that happens to be to a video, say in YouTube, they will actually create a thumbnail from that video in the email and make it clickable to go to YouTube automatically. So that basically happens if you just go to YouTube, select the URL that you're on, paste that into an email. When the person gets it, they'll get a little thumbnail to the video automatically. So that's nothing that you have to do in particular. It just gets done automatically in the background.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Joss, perhaps one of the things that always made me a little bit nervous about using online was the idea that, well, what if I want access to this document when I can't get an internet connection or something like that? Can you talk a little bit about how you could instead make sure that you save potentially all your files on your local hard drive rather than in the cloud?
I remember seeing that somewhere. I forget where it was. Make available offline.
Ah, okay.
So from file, make available offline, and then I guess it will save to your hard drive, and then you can access it from there.
Okay. Thanks. Natalie said in the chat, so creating a hyperlink within a doc is impossible. I'm sure it is. If you just type in a URL, I would be willing to bet that Google Docs automatically makes it a hyperlink. Am I right on that, Joss?
I believe you're right. It will be probably insert a link in. I don't insert.
Right now you're still sharing your just the PowerPoint. If you wanted to, you could stop sharing and then go back in and do a share and share your desktop.
Okay. Sorry. I thought I was sharing my desktop. Okay. No, that's not it.
So if you go back and share and then the top left option.
Okay. No. Okay. So insert.
We're still not sharing. You're not. You have to then click the share button in the bottom right.
Okay. Sorry. So that would be this one. Is that better?
And it says started. There we go. Yeah, got it.
Okay. I guess it's insert and a link. And then you would enter the link that you want into your document. Is that answering the question?
I think so. Natalie, has that got you there?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Any other questions we have? People can unmute themselves or put a question into the chat if you want.
It's Corrine. Hi, it's Corrine. Thanks, Joss. I missed most of the presentation because I got cut out. But what happens, I saw something about being restricted and restricted to like a group of people that you want, but what if the information that you're sharing has sensitive information? I guess you shouldn't be using Google Docs, right?
Well, what you can do is you can select what kind of rights they have and who has the rights. Right now it's restricted to just me, as you can see. I have only me and that in the list of people that are sharing. But if I want to add someone, for example, Alan, then I can add Alan and I will send him a link, and then he can use that to edit the document. So I can specify the rights. Is it just to read, or is it to read and edit? So you can define all kind of different parameters like that. So
okay. That answered part of my question. The other part is when you are sharing, how do you track the changes that people have made? Can you see that?
I never done that. But I think there is a history somewhere. I remember seeing a history somewhere, but I forgot where it was. But I think there is a history that you can show who has done the edit. Oh, yeah.
There is the ability to roll back changes as well.
Yeah.
Okay. Like undo.
If you look here, open comment history. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
There's a follow-up question there. Joss, is a list of restricted people linked to your contacts, or can you add anyone?
You can add, I think you can add anyone.
If it's restricted, you can only restrict it to people that have a Google account. because that's their only security model that they have at their disposal to ensure that you are selecting the right people or only the right people can get access to it. So as long as they've got a Google account, then it's no problem.
Yeah. I think anybody can view if you allowed anybody with the link. But if you want to edit, then you have to have more. You have to have a Google account. Yeah, I agree.
Even on the view, you can restrict that to only certain people, or have nobody on the view list if you want, and then have just editors. But you can restrict to individuals based on either the edit or the view capability. I've done that a lot through just sharing documents through Google Drive, where I can even leave it open for view. Anybody who has the link can get it, or you can restrict it. Okay, any last questions before we move on?
Yeah, it's Corrine again. How long can you keep documents on there? Can you set an expiry date, or do they clean out the Google Drive every so often?
As far as I know, it's forever. I'm not aware of a deadline that you can set. I'm not aware of that. Never heard of that.
The only thing I've ever known to expire is if you delete something, it will go into the recycle bin and it's recoverable for up to 30 days. But if you don't delete it, it will stay there for as long as your account is active. It'll be there.
Okay, thank you.
And if you give the rights to somebody, you can remove it also afterwards. So if you don't want that person anymore, just remove that person.
One interesting side effect of when you give rights to other people, if you go to delete that particular document, you actually get a warning from Google saying that you've shared this document with other people. Are you sure you want to delete it? Which you can go ahead and do. But it's kind of nice that they actually let you know that you've actually shared this document. And if you delete it, you're going to be removing other people's ability to access that document. So kind of cool. Okay, if people have other questions, by all means, jump in later on or throw it into the chat. We'll try and cover it off later. And at this point, I'll turn it over to Alan to take us through the deck for tonight.
Okay. Good evening, everyone. First thing is a follow-up from the discussion on the feature update to Windows 10, the version 2004. It arrived on my laptop on Sunday. It took an hour. It's three sessions of getting things ready, which is interesting. Two sessions of downloads. Two sessions of installation. At which point, after an hour, it had got to 86%. But I couldn't keep watching after that. When I came back later on, it needed four reboots to finish up. But now you can see it's installed. And the start menu is very pretty. So all I have to say that 2004 is on its way. It's the first of my machines that's got it.
I would just like to reiterate that people should be careful about getting it from anywhere other than the Windows Update, because the Windows Update site still has some blocks in place for certain pieces of hardware where there are not yet drivers that are compatible with 2004. And so if you go and get it from some other method, a direct download and so forth, which is available, those blocks will not take effect and you could end up with a problem. So I highly recommend that you only do it through Windows Update. If you want it aggressively, by all means, go there every day and do check for updates, and at some point it will be offered to you.
And if you get it next week, don't install it 10 minutes before the Zoom session.
Yes.
Okay, the first question we have in the queue is about email, and I think it was Peggy had noticed that some people are using Outlook and Gmail, and she is using Yahoo. But she's added Gmail as a kind of a secondary email address when she doesn't want to give out her main address. But Yahoo has problems, including adverts and apparently difficulty creating group lists. So the question is for everybody, which email provider is best and why? And to kick us off while you're all thinking about that, Gmail. I actually use Gmail as a kind of a secondary account. I find it works really well most of the time. It has a few little idiosyncrasies, but generally it works pretty well. Now, the good thing about it is it has a webmail interface, so you can access it through a browser. But you can also set your Gmail account as either POP or IMAP in an email client, and that's what I do. I use Thunderbird and use that to look at my Gmail messages. The other good thing is, if you're using Gmail as a secondary address, rather than having to go to the web and look all the time or have a secondary account, you can actually have Gmail automatically forward any messages that come into your inbox to your regular email address. So I have at least one account that I don't use very regularly, but that's essentially what happens. It sits there, and when anybody sends a message to it, it ends up in my real email box. The really good thing about Gmail is it's free. So you can have multiple accounts. You can use it for your regular email. And in that case, it's portable because you can change ISPs and you still got your same Gmail address. And because it's free, you can also create throwaway accounts and, you know, black hole type things where you want to give an email address to a company, but you don't want them bombard you with spam or whatever. So you just use a temporary address and throw it away if it gets lots of spam. Now, one of the downsides with Gmail is finding an email address that you want that's available. And clearly I'd like to have alan@gmail.com, but I can almost guarantee that's taken, and it's probably going to tell me that I have to use alan786539@gmail.com. which may or may not be a good thing. And the upside is it's really easy to establish a throwaway email address such as alan786539, which is almost certainly available. So anything you want, you can certainly have. So if anybody has any other email providers which they would like to recommend, just unmute your microphone or stick it in the chat. Natalie is telling you that her Yahoo accounts were hacked several times, and so she dumped it. And I have a couple of friends that have had similar experiences with Yahoo, but I think Chris will tell you that any of these email accounts can be hacked.
I suspect that none of the major ones are particularly susceptible to hacking or particularly susceptible to security. I think they all do security pretty well. You know, they can't afford to really have a lot of word out there about their accounts being hacked or nobody will use them. I haven't personally. I have a Yahoo account. I have an Outlook.com email address. Mostly I use those for testing. And, of course, I have my Gmail account, which I use most of the time. I haven't any problems with any of them. I do recommend that you have really good, not only password, but also if they give you the ability to unlock it using security questions, that you don't come up with security questions or answers to security questions that somebody could either guess or research about you. One of the things I give as an example in the program I give on password safety is to make sure that you either answer them with nonsense. So, you know, favorite author is pizza and things like that, and you store that in a password keeper, or you salt your answer with a secret word that you use all the time. So if your secret word is pencil, you know, favorite food might be pencil pizza. And favorite author might be Pencil Asimov or whatever. So because if somebody can guess your secret answers to security questions, they can get into your account. So that's one thing that I do recommend. We do have a question just going, stepping back just a little bit from Karen. Do you recommend installing version 2004 or Windows? Been delaying until I thought they had the bugs worked out. The only bugs they really have at this point beyond the normal monthly updates that fix problems is hardware that doesn't have drivers out yet, and you won't be offered it through Windows Update until such time as drivers are all available for your computer. So it's been out for quite a while, and there haven't been any major issues other than people who wanted it that had it blocked, and they're waiting for driver updates on that part. Bob Gowan mentioned Gmail has good spam filtering. Yeah, they do. I know that I think that Outlook.com has very good filtering on spam as well, and I believe Yahoo is pretty good on that as well. From Joss, Yahoo used to be very popular. Now I wonder how many customers they have and how they remain in business. Yeah, good question, I suppose, but they are still used by a lot of people.
There's a comment here by EOD with an NCF account, and I've had excellent luck with National Capital Freenet with respect to spam, security, reliability. They also allow for multiple disposable email accounts, which is very convenient.
Yeah, I tend to rah-rah for National Capital Freenet. They do a good job.
I have a little tip for the Gmail. I like Gmail, and I give my Gmail accounts out readily, and nothing against Lee Valley Tools. But when I give my email address to Lee Valley Tools, I put my regular Gmail address, but I put Bob space capital L capital V Harris, okay? And when I get my stuff from Lee Valley Tool, it'll say Bob LV Harris. And if they resell that email, I know that it comes, that it'll say Bob LV Harris. You got that from Lee Valley Tools. And I have other ones that'll say, so many of my emails come in with initials between my first and last name, and I know that I gave that to you, and that's you. So if they resell that, they'll keep that initials that I gave it to, not Walmart, but to Bob WM or W something Mark, whatever. Anyway, the middle name. My middle name decides, anyway, it governs. If they sell me, then I know where I was sold to.
And what are you going to do about that, Bob?
Not much. but so far, it's been very limited. But I get a lot of emails with my middle initials, and that's good. That's from you. That's what I wanted.
Yeah.
So I'm not resold too often. I haven't had a problem yet. But I'll know. So I'm many things to many people.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move on then. The next question is about internet service providers. And this is a question that was posed in the membership survey. So the question is, which internet service provider, ISP, do you use? And they're looking for cheaper plans for both web-based and cell phone, and also any new providers in the local area. So again, while you're thinking about that, I'll kick it off with my experiences with TechSavvy. They're actually based in Chatham, but it's a web-based service, so it's easy to contact them. They offer quite a range of services. You can have either a cable or a DSL connection. They have plans which run from 5 to 150 megabits per second, and clearly those higher speeds come with higher prices, so the bottom line is between about $35 to $68. And as an example, if you went for the cable 30, unlimited data. Now, all of their plans are unlimited data, so that doesn't really mean anything. But 30 megabits per second is essentially $50 a month. Now, on top of that, you need a modem. So you can either buy their modem for $160, or you can rent it for $13 and change per month. But if you're interested in TechSavvy and you keep your eyes open, every now and again they'll have a triple zero plan. And 000 means that you get a free modem, free installation, and free shipping. So you eliminate that purchase cost or the monthly rental and the setup fees.
Just a comment, Alan, on Tech Savvy and their pricing. I just got an email from them today saying that starting October 1st, the $49.95 package is going to be invoiced at $59.95, reason being that the federal government has pushed back on the lower rates for internet service providers can charge to third parties like Tech Savvy and National Capital Freenet and so forth. So almost certainly everybody's price, perhaps other than the major carriers, is likely to be going up.
Yeah, Ali's saying that a friend downtown has Tech Savvy, finds that the bandwidth isn't as good as she would have hoped.
If anybody's not getting the bandwidth that they've been promised, like if you're paying for 30 megabits per second, you know, slightly under, shouldn't be an issue or anything like that. But if you're getting significantly less, I would complain to the service provider. If it's Tech Savvy, they will have to go to either Rogers or Bell, depending on whether you're on DSL or cable. And they can argue the fact. And certainly on cable, you know, if you're at 30 megabit per second, that cable can provide an awful lot more than that. And so if it's not getting very, very close to 30 megabits per second, if that's what you're paying for, I would definitely complain about it.
Joss is saying he uses distribute.ca.
Distributel.
Distributel.ca. So he's been happy with them. Natalie says Bell gives refunds for rural customers who never get what they pay for.
Yeah, I certainly wouldn't put up with getting significantly less than what they're offering.
Now, Bob Walker here. If you're a rural customer, you're basically stuck with whoever has the closest tower to you. And if you're fairly far from any tower, you may have to put up a 50 or 60-foot antenna tower just to get access. And the further you are away, the slower speeds are going to be, regardless of whatever it is they guarantee. The other option you have is satellite internet, and that can be pretty disappointing as well. In a lot of cases with satellites, in some cases you upload through the satellite, in other cases your uploads go through the phone line. So.
Yuck.
And Karen's saying she lives in North Gore and has been happy with Fido home internet. And Ollie is asking, how do you test your bandwidth? I believe there's a website for that. And there is indeed, speedtest.net, I believe, is one of them.
Yeah, I go with CIRA because they're the Canadian Internet Service Provider. And theirs is performance. I'm typing it into the chat. So it's, I believe it's performance.
Yeah, CIRA is the Canadian Internet Registrar.
And it's performance.cira.ca, I believe. I will check that before I hit the send into the chat.
And Bob's suggesting you can use fast.com.
Yeah, so the performance.cira.net, .ca is it. So I think that's one of the more trustworthy ones because you know that they don't have anything to sell. They're not trying to con anybody. They're just trying to give it to you straight up. I always wonder a little bit about anybody else, speedtest.net, for example. So it's been reliable for me, but I always wonder, well, how are they making their money? How are they paying for this service, and how reliable is it? I don't know. So for what it's worth.
Yeah. Bob Walker here. Just a comment on the service in North Gore. I used to live there, and you have access to Bell DSL. In fact, I used to be able to walk out of my front porch and see the Bell Exchange from there. It was so close. And you also have access to Rogers. So any of the services like TechSavvy that piggyback on Bell or Rogers, you also have access to. So North Gore as a rural area is fairly well served. But if you go much further than that, you're pretty well stuck with wireless or satellite.
Okay, let's move on to the next one. The next one is on a theme. Are you a cord cutter? This is another one that comes from the membership survey. And the interest is over the air, TV, or some kind of streaming service. So again, while you're all thinking about which streaming services and over the air systems you use, let me just say the following. I tried using over the air with an indoor antenna, and one of the things you can do is check on tvfool.com, which will tell you what channels you're likely to be able to pick up using an antenna. Now, the picture is a kind of indoor antenna that you see a lot of different ones on Amazon. They're all kinds of different prices, $10 to $30 typically. Don't expect you're going to get 120 channels. I think on our TV here, we get about six. CBC Ottawa comes through really well, as does TVO. But I don't get CTV Ottawa at all. And PBS is coming from the States, but it's on a tower which is not line of sight for me, so I don't get any PBS signal. The adverts tell you that you can get 200 kilometers with an amplifier. My experience is the amplifier makes absolutely no difference whatsoever to the signal which I receive. So it's good for local news, TVO programs, but that's about it where I reside. I must say that's my personal experience, my location too. I'm using TechSavvy as my ASP, and I got rid of one of the major suppliers. So I signed up for their streaming TV service. And basically they do it as a bunch of modules. So you get like basic television for about $20 a month. And then if you want some of the specialty news channels like CNN and CTV News Network, whatever it's called, then that's $8 a month on top of that. If you're a sports fan, then there are various sports packages, so you can pay another $8 to $20 depending on which channels you want. And the PVR service, the video recording service, is cloud-based, which they offer on a $10 per month basis. All these are optional, and you can sign up for them and you can cancel them online as you wish. One of the things you did need when I signed up was some kind of Android TV device. And I settled for this NVIDIA Shield device. The long black tube there is the actual computer, and the vertical thing is the remote control. And it works quite well. don't think any... Oh, no.
So, yeah, we got some chats going on. Bill Van Dyke, you mentioned Bell Fi break to the house and ran a test, 272 down and 270 up. I'm curious, Bill, what are you paying for that service? Sounds real good. From Ollie, purchased several different indoor antennas and tested them out, but my rabbit ears work best. Oh, that's interesting. I certainly would have expected the specialized antennas to actually work better than rabbit ears, so that's cool to know. So I guess the takeaway from that is try just rabbit ears first and see if it works well. EOD at NCF says I get CTV Ottawa, live in Canada. They just did a reset of their equipment, never had to rescan. I presume that that's not an overly terrible thing to have to do, but I guess if you're just not getting service and don't know that that's what you have to do, that could be a problem. Tell me What is covered under Tech Savvy Basic TV? Can you fill that in?
Yes, you get, let's see, the basic one. You get the CBC local, CTV local, a whole bunch of American networks, ABC, NBC, PBS. You get TVO, but you get it in standard definition. I think I mentioned that a couple of Q&As ago. I told a lady at TechSavvy I could get better reception with a coat hanger. But she insists that they can't provide high-definition TVO. Makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. I see the email there, so I'll look up what exact... Oh, you can go on the website. You go on TechSavvy's website. It will tell you, A, whether you can receive service from them, and B, what various channels are available.
Okay, we have another comment from somebody in North Gower. Have a homemade $20 antenna with amp and pull in about 14 to 18 HD channels over the air. Very good.
I have a friend who lives in an apartment just down the road, but she's on the 12th floor and she gets really good signal.
Ah, yes. I guess as long as you're not there, you're not trying to get signals that are blocked by your building itself.
Yeah, it's a line of sight thing. So if you can see the tower that's distributing, you've got a much better chance of getting a decent signal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another comment is a lot of these antennas, despite any claims they have about being omnidirectional, are highly directional. So what you get depends on which way it's aimed.
My mother live in a residence, high-rise building, and her needs were very small. So instead of using Videotron, Rogers, or whatever cable TV that they offer, I just got an old TV, got one of those box, plug it, and she's happy with it. I mean, even though there is inside the building, the reception was fine most of the time. So, and the TV is free forever after that. Once you have paid for the box. So I thought it was an interesting option for those that have little needs.
Okay, I guess we can move on then, Alan.
Yep. So the next question is, is there any way of removing the pictures from around the world that Microsoft in its wisdom sends us? Every time I get an update, I have problems with my computer. And this isn't me, it's somebody else. I think it was Ollie, actually. I don't know, it might be Peggy. Anyway, to get rid of the Microsoft images, you can go to Settings and Personalization and Lock Screen. And the little image here shows you the lock screen, and by default, I think you get Windows Spotlight, which gives you all those nice images. If you change that to Picture, and there's a drop down there. You change it to picture or slideshow, and then you can choose your own picture to display on the lock screen. Or if you tell it a folder, Chris tells me it will show all the pictures in the folder to be displayed. And if you want to disable the lock screen completely, this comes courtesy of Micheline on the members forum and Tech Republic, the website. You navigate to See Windows System Apps, and you right-click on this folder, Microsoft Lock App, and a bunch of characters, and you rename it, and they suggest renaming it to the same name with Disabled stuck on the end. And when you do that, then it disables the lock screen. So what happens then is if the lock screen kicks in, instead of a picture coming up, which you then have to swipe away before you can actually enter your credentials on the next screen, and it goes straight to the screen with the credentials. However, as far as I can tell, you have to use an administrator's account to do that rename. If you use a regular account, which I normally do, it will say, do you want to allow this rename to continue? And you say yes, but it doesn't actually rename the folder. So I had to log out of my regular user account, log into my admin account, and do the rename that way. And the really disappointing thing from my perspective was that when I boot the computer, I still get that lock screen image, which I have to swipe away before I can get to the credentials. So it works on the actual lock screen when the display times out, but it's still there when you boot the computer. So if anybody knows how to get rid of that image when you first boot up and go straight to the credentials screen, send us an email. Send me an email, because that's what I want to know.
It's Kareem. Rather than Microsoft pushing out the images they want, perhaps we should ask them to show images of, let's say, Ottawa, if you're in Ottawa, or Campville, and they can localize it for us. I wonder if there's any way to do that.
Send them something on Windows Feedback.
Yep.
And good luck.
Okay, good luck. Hey.
No, it's true. It's a good idea. I mean, Microsoft pays a lot of attention to the Feedback Hub. And so if you click on your start menu and start typing in Feedback, it'll come up with an app, and you can go in and you can search to see if there are any existing comments that people have made, suggestions that they do that, and upvote them. If you do see something, it's more effective if you upvote an existing comment rather than creating a brand new one. But if you can't find anybody else having made such a suggestion, certainly enter it in there. And Microsoft does pay attention to them, especially if you get upvotes on your suggestion. And that, to me, sounds like a reasonable thing that I think a lot of people might be interested in having. So they may well do that.
Yeah, and I'm going to check into that. Thanks, Chris, because we can, if we want it to look pleasant, then we have beautiful photos of national parks and all sorts of things.
On the other hand, I find that the Windows Spotlight is kind of cool. It has things from all over the world, and if you actually click on the words that appear in the middle of the screen, once you log in, it'll actually load up Microsoft Edge, of course, and take you to a website with more information about that locale.
Yeah, that's kind of cool, too.
Yeah.
Okay, so I keep pushing this to everybody, but if anybody's a member and you haven't subscribed to the member forum, that's where that little tip came from. You just have to send an email, and you can join the announcements list. You can have the newsletter sent to you by email. And you can join the member forum, which is essentially a 24/7 Q&A session. Before we move on, I see a couple of things. It is $5,300, and it's basically $102 a month. And Chris, can you talk again about download speed and how close it should be to what we're supposed to get?
I'm paying for 30 megabit per second, and I typically get at least 29. If I got under 25, I would certainly be complaining. But between 25 and 30, I'm not sure I would. There are, various things that can cause slowdowns. Certainly on when you're on something like cable service, if you have a lot of people that are using the Rogers or whatever your service provider is in the neighborhood, it can impact the overall performance. But I would certainly expect it to be, within 5% of what they're charging me for. Otherwise, I would either ask for a discount or ask them to talk to the techs and get it fixed.
Yeah, it's a good idea to check it multiple times too, because it's good to have a kind of a reasonable idea that it's a consistently bad service.
Yeah, I agree.
But I will fix things. I know one time I was with I think it was Bell, and I complained because my speed was abysmal, and they told me that it was because the platform was too far from the central office. So I said, well, is there no closer platform? And they said, well, yes, there is.
Ah.
I suggested that the answer was pretty obvious. And indeed, they did move me to a different platform, and I got the speed I was paying for. So that was reasonable.
Worth complaining.
Okay, now here's a question for all you Samsung phone people, because I don't think I or Chris have the answer to this one. Sue, I think, has a Samsung smartphone and is using the email app with both Gmail and Windows Live Mail. And she has two email addresses for herself on the phone. One is correct and one has been mistyped. How do I delete the incorrect one? Because it doesn't seem to be in the contacts. So where do email addresses live in Samsung phones using Gmail and Windows Live Mail? Waiting with bated breath.
Yeah, you have to
unmute yourself to answer for your Rocky's chat.
My personal experience has always been that it uses the one contact list I have, so I've never run into this particular problem.
I'm wondering if it's actually something to do with using Gmail and Live Mail. Is it a contact list on the web server?
Yeah, I don't know.
Because I found Gmail is odd, and I found that I was sending email to people, and I was going to export my contacts as a test or something else, and there weren't any contacts in the list. But there's another folder, which is something like, other addresses or alternate addresses or something obscure, but it was where it was storing all the email addresses. Anyway, it looks like everybody has to think about that one and send us an email, because we don't seem to have an answer right now.
Yeah, can I may have a follow-up question?
Can I ask that same question for like regular email, like Gmail? Sometimes, like for example, the other day I typed in an address and they entered it with .com and it was supposed to be .ca, and now I've got this .com listing in my Gmail account and I don't know how to get rid of it.
Okay, I have to look at that one. And
yeah, if anybody has any ideas, you can send it into the suggestion box email address. We can do a follow-up next week.
Just a little question about that. Are each email associated to an account? And if so, what about canceling one of the accounts?
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'd want to know where his email address is before I start canceling accounts. So we'll take a look at it. Next question, still email. What causes a message to go to either drafts or outbox on my phone? And I think I know the answer to this one. So if you can save a message. So you can save an incomplete message, or it can be a complete message. And if you save the message, then you actually save it to the drafts folder. And it acts like a placeholder, so it just stores them temporarily. You can then open it later on, you can finish the email, and then you can send it as normal. One of the things that can happen is if your email client, I use Thunderbird, and Thunderbird by default auto-saves messages to the drafts folder every so many minutes, which is configurable. So you can end up with messages in your drafts folder just because the email client decided to store them there. Typically, once you pull a message out of drafts and send it, then it will be deleted from drafts and it will end up in your sent folder if that's what you configure your email program to do. Now, some email programs will actually save messages which you're composing to the outbox folder. And again, once you send the message, then it deletes the message from outbox and essentially moves it to the sent folder. But Chris has heard of suggestive instances where messages get stuck in the outbox. And that can happen if the internet goes down. Or I've actually seen it when Thunderbird suddenly decides it's gone offline and I have to turn it back online to access the message again. Once it's in the outbox, then it depends on the email system. Some systems will automatically send everything in the outbox once the access is restored to the internet, or you may have to go in there, open the message from the outbox and resend it manually. Again, I don't know if anybody has any other thoughts on drafts and outboxes and things like that.
I think that's pretty much it. It has been my experience anyways. So I think my perspective, it covers it.
Let's move along then. I think this was, I forget who it was. Once in a while when I shut my computer down, a pop-up says update and shut down or update and restart. I usually choose update and shut down, but I wonder what the computer is updating. And what's happening here is that Windows Update is the culprit. It's trying to process updates, but you want to turn the computer off so it can't continue. So this pop-up is saying, let me finish the updates, and then I will automatically shut the computer down for you or restart the computer, depending on which of these options you wanted to go with.
Yeah, this will actually only occur if you have an update that Windows is trying to apply where it can't be done on a live system. It has to be done. It's trying to replace a component that is critical to the operation of Windows, so it can't be replaced while Windows is running. So in that case, you will get that prompt because it'll do it when it reboots. And it doesn't really matter from a fundamental technical point of view whether you say update and shut down or update and reboot. It will still apply the update, but it's just a matter of whether you want to use the computer immediately again. You would choose the update restart. If you are done, just say update and shut down, and then just leave the computer running. It'll finish up and shut the computer after it's done.
Okay, and that's the end of the prepared questions. So do we have any other questions, any comments on the foregoing, or anything anybody would like to share with the group? And you have to unmute yourself to answer.
Chris, it's Corrine again. Can you put the slide up of the upcoming session?
Alan has got the slide, so you have to tell him which one you want.
The one on the library, the Ottawa Public Library, the ones that are coming up.
Oh, that one. Yeah, that's if the easiest, because we're either going to end now or if you go to. Let me just get you the exact URL, and I'll paste it into the chat window. And
the next Tech Cafe is on the 14th of next month.
Yeah.
It's our favorite person doing Windows tune-up.
Okay, Corrine, I paste it into the chat window, the OPL presentations on our website. Okay. You can get a link from there to take you to the actual registration page.
Great, thank you.
Okay.
And I'll just mention, because we're nearly done, 8:28, I make it. Before that, the next monthly meeting of the club is on September the 9th, and it's an introduction to Raspberry Pi. And our speaker will be coming from Victoria, BC, live on Zoom. And you can look at the website. You'll get all the details for that meeting. As I say, the tech cafes are starting up in the fall, and the first one is on the 14th. And you do need to register with the library for that, because they'll send you a link. And we have a question. We have a question. My laptop is starting to feel a bit hot after several hours. Last night I did a backup just in case. What might be causing the heat? So I take it this is something that you haven't noticed before. It may be dust in the system.
One suggestion I would make is to make sure that there is no dust inside the computer. I was surprised how much dust there was, despite the lady was very, very clean, but there was so much dust. So when you remove the cover, did a bit of vacuum, and it did a lot of good.
Yeah, that's for a desktop. It's a bit trickier with a laptop, of course.
Especially one that's sealed.
Yeah. Yeah, some of them can be quite tricky to open up for sure. One thing I would suggest is to make sure that you're not blocking the ventilation holes while you're using it. So on the underside, there's going to be a lot of ventilation holes. And if you make sure you're on a solid surface, not on a fabric or something like that, that'll block air. You might even boost it by prop it up a little bit so that there's better airflow under it. Might be a solution that would help as well.
Yeah, just a piece of advice here. Be very, very careful about vacuuming or using these compressed air cans to clean all the dust out, because that can generate tremendous amounts of static electricity, which will really fry the integrated circuits in your computer, and then it'll be dead for sure.
We have one suggestion. We have one suggestion on the laptop is to you can actually buy a laptop powered base with a fan and cord, which will increase the airflow around your laptop. So that could help to keep it cool.
And one suggestion, if you are using an air can to push some air, make sure that you are outside. If you do that from inside, you'll regret it.
I would really suggest not using compressed air for cleaning out anything. It's too easy to accidentally get the propellant coming out and onto your components.
I've seen things about overspeeding the fan, actually, if you're blowing the fan around. It sounds a bit weird, that, but, well, something else. Just don't go blowing around everywhere.
Yeah, I've heard that as well, and one of the suggestions I heard was that you stick a pen or something like that in at the fan so that it can't spin when you do blow it or whatever.
And there's an interesting question there. The dial-up service of the cottage, what web service do you recommend, and what browser do you recommend? I think you could use any browser. I'm not sure how you get dial-up service at a cottage. I know one of our members has a bell line, which is an old party line, which he charges nothing for, but he's grandfathered, so he spends a few dollars a month for his dial-up service. I would think you'd have to use Bell, right, for dial-up.
I just have to tell one little story, and this is a friend of mine. Her son relies heavily on using, you know, always being connected, and he has a security system with cameras at home, and he has a cottage, and what was happening, it was he was having parcels delivered, and they would just leave them on his doorstep, and they would always be stolen. And he, in previous times when he was in Ottawa, he could see who was doing this. But once he was up at the cottage, he didn't have a connection at all. So it's really interesting what people assume is available anywhere.
Yeah. Okay. I don't see any other new questions in the chat at all. Do we have any last ones or anybody wants to unmute themselves before we call it a night? We're at 8:34 right now.
I would say it's a great evening, and thank you all for attending. I enjoyed the evening. Never seen so many folks not wearing masks.
We did have a comment from Joss on the web browser to use, and Opera. He says it is very fast, so that might be a good option to try Opera to see if it performs better on a dial-up connection. Okay.
And don't forget, if anybody has any questions or things you want to share or answers to things that we post, send them along to the suggestion box, and we'll have them available next week.
Thanks very much for attending, folks.
Thanks, everyone.
Well, thanks to everyone else.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.